So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts Micro. I am your host, Bob Mackey, and the topic for today, we're doing a listener mail episode about the Mario series. I happen to know one of the biggest Mario fans on the planet, and introduce yourself, please.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert. That's H-E-N-E-R-E-Y-G on Twitter.
That's right.
Getting that in early, but yeah, well, actually, you're recording this in my apartment, surrounded by thousands of dollars of Mario stuff that is now boxed up.
They're all boxed up from what? Your future job at Future, right?
Yeah, back when I worked at Games Radar, I had the Mario desk, and I had just the Mario section of toys on the in my desk, and it started with like 10 that I kind of just brought with me, and then I just kept buying stuff on eBay, or when I went to Japan, I bought more stuff, but it's also, it's not that I'm just a collector of Mario things, but it is that I am a huge Mario fan. Yeah. I'd say it is my favorite franchise is the Mario franchise.
I am a huge Mario fan, and I was actually surprised you didn't bring any of your Mario stuff to the job we both used to work at, because everyone's desk there was so boring, and it made me mad. I'm like, we're all the nerd website. Why do you have a picture of your family on your desk? There should be action figures and statuettes and weird things that creep me out. I was that guy. Yes. I had to bring all my stuff in.
You did that. I felt a certain, you know, unspoken pressure to be like, no, if you have a favorite sports team, you can have a photograph of them or some pennant.
But yeah.
When you started, you gave me more bravery to add stuff, but it was slow and it was only new things. I also didn't want to bring, it was partially too because when I left Games Radar and I had to box up my desk, it was eight boxes of stuff, and I had to like get a lift all the way back.
And they
home.
Probably mailed some stuff to you too.
No, I just boxed all. But I was like, I'm not leaving this for any of you guys to buy. I was thinking like, oh, I'll sell these on eBay. I haven't sold them.
I'm the same way. I don't have just Mario stuff, but I have just giant tubs of things that used to be at my desk at 1UP and other places. I have no real desk now, no real space. So that'll be going to someone else's grandchildren because I won't have any.
It's not just Mario stuff. I owned lots of other toys there. Bob, if he looks to his left there, he can see a giant set of pins that are framed of every WrestleMania from WrestleMania 1 through 20.
This is like a museum in here.
Yeah, except it's all in crates. It's more like the end of Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
The Raiders of the Lost Ark, not Indiana Jones.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
So this is not an unpacking your desk and getting fired podcast. I can't be fired from Retronauts. As much as people have tried to do that, it won't happen.
But Mr. Retronauts, Bob Servo.
Is this the way Bob should really be acting? Yes, it is, and I won't stop. But yes, I asked a lot of you on Twitter with very short notice to please ask us your Mario questions and Mario comments. I usually do a listener mail episode every year. That is still happening, but I needed an episode idea, and I needed to get it recorded quickly, and luckily Henry lives like 15 minutes away from me, so this is all happening in the satellite Talking Simpsons studio. So let's get started with some of our questions here, and the first one is from Francisco Javier Juarez Cerdillo, and I apologize if I mangled your name, Francisco, and he wants to say, do you think that the Mario series will become more and more easy, more forgiving with each iteration? Henry, what do you think about this?
You know, they've kind of gone up and down on that, really. This reminds me of Super Meat Boy when that came out. The developers of that actually did a really cool chart on difficulty in classic Mario games and how it kind of changed, and how they wanted to scale Super Meat Boy's difficulty kind of differently based on that. And they showed how it was really difficult in Super Mario Brothers 1, and it kept scaling up. And they continued that scaling up of difficulty, you know, through each stage, but they were much more, as the series went on, they were much more giving with one-ups, they were much more forgiving with, like, damage, and telling you where problems were. And then, I think I mentioned this a lot on the Super Mario 64 episode, but you can tell Nintendo felt a real problem when they went to 3D, that mm-hmm. they're like, we have to go to 3D, but we lost all these people who think 3D is too hard just to navigate. And so, to offset that, they invented all these things to make it easier, or to choose to make it easier, like having a character pop up and say, hey, you know, you want this to be easier? I can do that for you. And then that kind of transitioned into, in 3D land, they basically just give you a million lives. You'll never run out of
that
lives.
That game is way too easy. And someone yelled at me on Twitter for disliking it, but I was just too bored to make it to the better half of the game. One day I will make it.
It's unfair that they hold the better game in the second half after that. When I reviewed that, they actually had a note in there that was like, don't tell everybody about the real game that's after this. I was like, well, this really makes it hard to review.
Don't tell anyone it gets better. Yeah, I mean,
and so just to finish, and 3D World did that as well. And now I actually like where Odyssey is going, because Odyssey is just like, you lose coins when you die, but you'll never run out of coins. Let's not even pretend there are lives anymore.
I'm so glad they got rid of lives. I mean, to answer this question in my own interpretation, I agree with you, Henry, but I feel like difficulty depends on the Mario variants. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like the Galaxy ones were moderate to highly difficult. In fact, Galaxy 2 was basically just like, you know what you're doing, and mm-hmm. we're going to give you some really hard levels. And there are some really bastard levels in that game.
Oh, yes.
I have not gotten all the shines in Galaxy, mainly because that Manta Ray level sucks. I hate it.
Yeah,
but Galaxy 2 is even more difficult. And those games are great, but I feel like 3D Land was too easy. 3D World was a little too easy, but it was a little more challenging. And I hope Odyssey does follow the path that Mario 64 took, and maybe not Mario Sunshine. we've come a long way since then, but I hope there's a good balance between, you know, letting you explore and also, you know, trying to throw some obstacles in your path.
All right, well, I'll read the next one here from Scott TV. Did the wait between Mario 2 and Mario 3 feel endless to anyone else? It feels like this forgotten time in Mario history, because all the marketing was based around Super Mario Brothers 2, so you would have the school supplies and apparel that had to maintain the Arabian theme. There's a part of my brain that still feels a sense of freshness when I see the Super Mario 3 title screen font. I know this era very well myself, too, because when I super duper got into Mario, I was 5 or 6 in 1986, 87. And when I first saw Super Mario Brothers, I had to have it. The kid next door had an NES and was playing the game. I was like, well, I have to get this. And when I finally got it and really got into Mario, actually it was like 2 had just come out and the Super Mario Brothers Super Show had just started airing. And in America, at least, you could tell much of the licensing was kind of split between licensing stuff from Super Mario Brothers 1 and licensing stuff from Super Mario Brothers 2, though more on the side of Super Mario Brothers 2, because it gave you more characters to work with. And so they were kind of stuck in keeping the themes and the enemies of 2 over 1 in all these advertisements. And so when 3 finally came out in America, it was a huge change from what they've been advertising and all that stuff. Though, I mean, I can't even, when you're 7, 2 years may as well be a million years.
Yeah, and actually, I think I was listening to some NPR podcast or something, maybe not as boring as that sounds, but they were explaining the scientific reason that as you get older, your perception of time gets narrower. Mm-hmm. And it's very simple. It's that when you're young, everything is a new experience. So everything is like demarcated in more concrete terms. But now that we're older and we're in our little ruts, like what is 2015 compared to now? Mm-hmm. It's like that is exactly what 1988 was compared to 1990 to a 35-year-old back then. But if you were 8, that 2-year wait between 2 and 3 in America was just endless. Like 2 entire school years, 2 entire summers. So many memories.
Yeah, so it definitely changed my perception of what Mario was when 3 finally came out. especially loved the Super Mario Brothers 3 cartoon. Made me so happy because
it's the best of those cartoons, and it's still bad.
The cartoons are awful. Yeah. They're bad.
It was the most faithful, though.
It was the most faithful, which is what I loved about it. I wonder if Nintendo. It'd be pretty cool to interview somebody who had worked on that, both those shows back then, because it definitely felt like between Super Show and 3, that Nintendo was like, you can't just make shit up. They can't go to Star Wars world.
Yes, like, that was the worst part of that Super Show cartoon. I think I've remarked upon it before, but it was just like, they couldn't even write original stories. It's just like, just call him Coop Vader, and he could be Mario, Cloud Walker, or whatever. Just write the damn script.
Yes.
But yeah, so hopefully that answered your questions. And we have a question from Guillermo Jimenez, and he wants to know, what do you think of Koji Kondo and for SMS Shinobu Tanaka's use of melody in Super Mario World, Super Mario 64, and Super Mario Sunshine? As you know, all three games repurpose one main melody for a majority of their respective soundtracks, remixing them and arranging them in often surprising ways. Indeed, it took me years to figure it out. I think it's a subtle way of creating an identity for each game, yet the arrangements are distinct enough to avoid a sense of repetition or laziness. It also makes Yoshi's Island feel even more like an outlier, since it's the one Mario game of the era not to follow this pattern. Love your show. Thank you, Guillermo. I like the idea. I feel like you need to have more variations than something like Super Mario World would do, or, you know, Super Mario World is like the biggest one in my head, because there's that main theme that gets remixed like five times. There's a overworld theme version of it. There's the athletic theme version of it. There's the underwater theme version of it, the ghost house theme version of it, and the fortress theme version of it. I feel like that's great, but that is also a soundtrack in 1990. Mm-hmm. So you don't need as many songs. And you see like a lot of these old composers that still compose have a 8 or 16-bit mindset when composing music for an album of songs. Like, I'm thinking in particular of Koichi Sugiyama, the Dragon Quest guy. Yes, he is also 90 years old, yeah. But it's like, dude, we need more than one town theme in this game. It's 2017. Like, yeah. Those games still have a very rigid, this is the field theme, this is the dungeon theme, like, very rigid, like, collection of, like, holes to fill for making an old video game soundtrack. But I feel like you really need to do more with it than Koji Kondo did in 1990.
Yeah, well, I would say with Sugiyama, too, that he's probably in the position of, like, unquestionable. Knowing how, having some idea how Japanese seniority works, it feels like an unquestionable position. Like, whatever he gives you, you can't change that.
You can have men killed, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, one of my favorite approaches to Mario music relatively recently now, it is actually within 9 years ago, but Galaxy 2 and Galaxy both had amazing music, and they were very clear of like Koji Kondo was like music overseer, like there in the making ofs, but he kind of was just about keeping the style correct and supervising other people's compositions.
I think he might just do the main melody and supervision, maybe write a few songs. I think he was the guy who wrote the new field or new overworld theme in New Super Mario Brothers. I think that was him. And that song is very annoying now. I don't like it. Yeah, at least they stop singing.
Yes. So Mike Blount asks, with Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle being more or less a successful spinoff from the core Mario games, what other franchises would you like to see combined with the Mario universe to create new spinoffs? Bonus question, what type of game would each of your answers be? That is an interesting question. I think Mario needs to fit with cute characters that fit with him. It is much
so not Rabbids is what you're saying. Look, I don't like the Rabbids.
No, I hate seeing the Rabbids when I'm playing this game, but I do love the game. It's XCOM. I love
it's
XCOM.
It's true. I mean, yeah, I apologize for that. I mean, Rabbids are fine. Rabbids are fine. They're cute enough.
I hate
in a very French way.
Yeah, I am more into the idea of cuteness from like the Japanese or American standard.
The correct kind of cuteness is Japanese cuteness. I'm sorry if that makes you mad.
Rabbids are too asymmetrical and gross. I don't like that. But anyway, a cute series that could cross over with. I mean, he has crossed over with just about every major Japanese series he could at this point. I was going to say Dragon Quest, but he did that in Fortune Street.
Yeah, Fortune Street.
I think I'd be up for another Fortune Street that maybe makes it slightly more approachable to Americans, because the game is basically Monopoly plus the stock market.
Yes, and the huge... I only played the Wii version. I know it's been around for like 20 years or whatever, but what blew my mind was it takes a long time to play a game, and there's no way to save a game and then come back to it later. It's the dumbest thing.
Yeah.
But what surprised me about that localization is, oh my god, like, So the Princess of Moonbrook from Dragon Warrior 2 is a character in the game.
That's
and
crazy.
All of her dialogue is full of like dog puns, because in the game she starts as a dog and you uncurse her. And I'm like, only I could know this. Who are they localizing this for? And I'm sure they lost a lot of money.
Yeah. Oh, I'm certain they did. I had heard it was just because Nintendo was like, we got to have something on the Wii.
Yeah.
They'd never.
Was that like 2012?
It was 2012. Yeah. It was the year before Wii U. And they're like, we got to get something for the Wii. So they'd never localized Itadaki Street before. I remember being at the E3 where they announced it and it was playable. There's obviously no line to go to it. And when I played it, I was like, I told the person, I'm so happy you guys did this, but I also can't believe you did.
Like, yes.
We've never had an Itadaki Street in America before this.
Yeah, it
because
was
because it was too is because it is too weird in Japanese.
I'm trying to think of what Mario could cross over with. I guess it counts with Pac-Man, the Mario Kart arcade version. He was crossed over with Pac-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I don't know. Maybe not Mega Man. I really don't know. I mean, you're right. He did cross over with basically everybody. Sonic, it happened.
Yeah.
That was the most obvious one.
Well, perhaps a way to think of it, too, is think of, like, what's a genre Mario hasn't mastered yet? And, like, I guess there's, like, real-time strategy, but Pikmin has already kind of got that. And
yeah, and Mario's too big for Pikmin. Mm-hmm. He would crush them all.
He'd squish him on his feet. He'd go like, ooh.
So Muteki asks, I wondered if Mario 64 took some of its ideas from the cult classic animated short Face Like a Frog by Sally Cruikshank, animator who did stuff for Sesame Street in addition to independent stuff like this. The surreal, even for Mario imagery, the idea of the cursed mansion slash castle, and maybe then stuff like the eel is inspired by the left field Danny Elfman purple lizard character who
what
comes in
hell?
To sing a bluesy song saying not to go in the basement. I have not seen this.
I've not seen this either, yo.
Muteki goes on to say there's distinctive general similarity in visual theming. Do look up the Don't Go in the Basement song sequence from that film, since it's excellent. And it's clear that some of the longer time Mario staff have taken inspiration from several American cartoons. But at the same time, the film's incredibly obscure and the similarities are still pretty broad. I may well be talking out of my ass on this one, but it's certainly interesting to me, at least, to think about. I'm going to say thank you for the comment, but no.
Probably not.
I mean, if they did, they probably wouldn't want to say, like, I saw this movie and got an idea, because I think Japanese creators are a little more reserved.
Yeah.
And most, actually, not just Japanese creators, most people are afraid to say when you're interviewing them what they're inspired by. And that's a question I always ask, and they are always like, oh, I can't talk about that. I actually play games, and I'm talking to my caller.
They were probably also told by PR,
that too,
like,
yeah.
Don't
I mean,
say this. We could get sued by somebody if you say this.
It surprised me when I interviewed the XCOM developers for the first time they brought that game back in like 2012.
Mm-hmm.
They flat out said, like, we love Final Fantasy Tactics. We love Advance Wars.
That's
we love
awesome.
These games. I'm like, oh my God, you can talk to me like a person. There was no PR person in the room. That's why.
Well, that's a nice change. The closest I had to that openness was from, was from Yuji Horii going back to Dragon Quest, where I asked, like, oh, what Western games have you been playing lately? And he just immediately said, like, oh, Heavy Rain, been playing that. It's pretty good.
Yeah, actually, Itagaki, because he was cut loose from Konami, not Itagaki, Igarashi, rather.
Itagaki
would not talk to me.
No.
Igarashi, Koji Igarashi, I asked him what he was playing, and he said, I play a lot of Monster Hunter with my son. And I thought that was cute. And he said, like, a lot of the ideas of that are going to Bloodstain are coming from him thinking about Monster Hunter, like crafting and different item drops and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to that game. I kickstarted it. Looking forward to it.
I got to talk to Itagaki for once. And
Igarashi or Itagaki?
Itagaki.
Okay.
And it was promised to be 30 minutes. And after 10, he was like, this is the last question. And then I thought I'd get to interview him again. The year they announced his Devil's Third game was coming to Wii U. And then, like, he canceled and subbed in a coworker of his at the last minute. Like,
he just put on sunglasses and was like, I am Itagaki now.
I honestly, like, this is just my speculation here. Based on how things turned out with Nintendo and Devil's Third, I wouldn't be surprised if Itagaki was, like, pissed off at Nintendo and just said, I'm not doing this.
They still published it. I can't believe they still published that game.
All right. Isaac 25p Pence, I guess, says, which main series Mario game disappointed you the most? For me, it was Super Mario Galaxy 2. That was me gasping.
I gasped off mic.
This is because the game had the potential to be better than Galaxy 1, but in the end, it just ended up being a regular Mario game. Not a bad game at all. I still give it an 8.5 out of 10, but Galaxy 1 was 9.8 out of 10.
Wow. If 8.5 out of 10 is your biggest disappointment, that's still pretty cool.
Yes.
No offense, buddy.
I mean, Isaac, I absolutely disagree with you.
Me too.
I I prefer Galaxy 2 to Galaxy 1. They are both great games, but it, in my opinion, Galaxy 2 streamlines the small amount of BS that I was like, eh, this is taking me a while. Like, this hub world's too big.
Just on a giant head, and it's great.
Yeah, just like, you're on this giant head. Here's Yoshi. We're speeding this up. We improved every idea we had in the first one and have 800 new ideas. Like, I love Galaxy 2. But to answer his question, I don't want to... You may hear me rag on Super Mario Sunshine a lot very soon.
Oh, yeah, you were on that episode.
Yeah, so... That definitely was close to the most disappointing for me, but actually I would say of mainline Mario games, the first new Super Mario Brothers, because to do that, to make the first ever 2D Mario game from the real team in a decade, and then for it to be like, oh, it's 2.5D, it's not as creative as I would have hoped, this feels like the B team. It would have been difficult to have even any higher expectations than I had for it. So I was probably set up for disappointment, but that was mine.
I think I would say Mario Sunshine, but you can hear us complain a lot about that in a future episode. And please, please don't get mad. We gave it a chance, but I agree with Henry, actually. That was a huge disappointment for me. And I feel like it gave Mario this really ugly makeover that he's just kind of breaking out of now.
Yeah.
Like, now they're coming back to embracing the 2D art again and making him less like a stiff CGI DreamWorks-y creation. But yeah, I agree. Like, I felt like it was uninspired. I thought some things were very anti-Mario, like... get a power up in another stage and then come back to a stage you already finished and hold on to that power up. It's just like, you usually give me the tools I need within a stage for the most part. I feel like that was like really anti-Mario. So
yeah, it wasn't until 3D Land I felt that they rediscovered what was great about Mario 2D art. Though they still don't do pixel Mario art. Those days are over. But that they at least had the, you know, you'll get letters from Peach and then it's an original drawing of Mario art. I think if it's not by Yoichi Kotabe, then it is very much in his style.
Yes, they found a good protege. And if he's still doing it, God bless him. So let's move on to Zachary Walton, who says, most kids... NESs came with Mario and it was their first exposure to video games. The friendly neighbor across the street gave me her son's NES when he moved out of the house, and it only had games like Wisdom Trees, King of Kings, and Bible Adventures.
Whoa.
Wow. I got my hands on Super Mario Brothers a year later. So I think I have more of an appreciation for Mario than most because he saved me from having to stack animals and toss them into an ark for the umpteenth time. I want to know what that mother's story was. She probably found it at like a Christian bookstore or whatever. Like, oh, they make Bible games for this thing, but they only made two.
I can finally inspire my child.
I think there's more than two. I think there's like four or five. There's like Sunday Fun Day and something with Moses in it. Maybe that is King of Kings. Truly, you are the King of Kings.
Well, and just to make this somewhat current, I saw, I believe it was either you or Jeremy bringing up the like, I Am 8-Bit is remanufacturing a Street Fighter 2 cartridge for the Super NES, and he was very clear of like, this is not, like, everybody's treating this like it's new. No, Wisdom Tree did make new Super NES cartridges. Nobody wanted them, but they were doing it.
Yeah.
So Ryder Rigo says, their question is, what are your favorite Mario products? Ooh, boy, it's a good one for me. What foreign products with Mario's visage on it do you wish you can get? What are your favorite Mario commercials? What are your favorite features of a Mario game? You know what? These are all too many questions. Let's stick to the products ones.
Yeah, let's
and
go for that one.
So, boy, the products one is really hard for me because, like I said at the beginning, I own hundreds of Mario things, but... as a kid, my favorites were anything close to a Mario action figure, but they just had PVC shapes. So today, when frickin' Figma and Nendoroid make actual posable, awesome Mario figures that are in the correct shape for the character, like his actual proportions and happy little face, I love it. And they're extra cute. Japan makes all the best Mario toys as well. Like there's just something a little about Mario toys that I've seen made in America that they can't get his nose right. It's little things like his nose needs to be a perfect sphere, but they get it kind of flat. It's just
I also, growing up, I was also very disappointed by the Mario merchandise because it was all weirdly off model. Like, I would just buy anything that had Mario or was like in a Mario shape, like a bubble bath container, like a little coin bank where he looked like he was melting on it, and like gum containers where it was kind of just like a gum Mario. But did you say what your favorite thing was?
So my favorite of... It would be between the Nendoroid of Mario, but also there were these really cool kind of like almost dioramas of Mario that
diorama
that they were in 3D shapes, but they also made sound effects. It was one of the first things I bought when I moved to Japan.
Yes.
And my favorite one was, it is the Super Mario end of stage, you know, stair, block stairs with the Koopa shell on it. And you can make Mario jump on it until it makes the one up sound.
That is a deep cut.
I really love that one for its referentialness.
I've said this on the, I believe, the Yoshi episode from earlier this year, but my favorite figures that I have, or favorite Mario products, are little figures. I think they're by Metacom.
Those are the greatest.
What Metacom does, and they make regular figures too, but it's like, Mario looked like this once, and we're going to make that version of him in 3D as a figure.
Perfectly.
So my favorite one, I love the Mario Arts from the Mario Brothers arcade game. In fact, it's been the wallpaper on my phone for like over a year. It's blocked by messages from Chris Antista right now. But
I know the art.
But yes, I love how Mario and Luigi look on that marquee art. They look like Fleischer Brother cartoons meets anime from like the 70s. So Metacom made versions of them that look just like that. I bought both Mario and Luigi. They also made Yoshi in his proper form, Dinosaur Yoshi with a saddle. But other things that they have that I don't have are Mario from the Mario 1 box, who looks different. He's a Miyamoto drawing, not a...
Kotabe redrew it. Kotabe based his Mario style on that art. But yeah, the Japanese box art for Super Mario Brothers 1 was a Miyamoto drawing.
Yeah, and that's when Bowser was based on the Ox King from Journey to the West. Yes, Journey to the West did inspire Mario Brothers, as it inspired everything in Japan ever.
And Peach looks like about 2 feet tall.
Yeah, she's weird looking. But yeah, they also make Mario from that cover and Link from the cover of Zelda 1. Those are deep cuts. But yeah, my favorite ones are the Mario and Luigi from the Mario Brothers arcade game with their little dorky hats.
And also my favorite commercial of Mario is really... My favorite American commercial is the Super Mario 3 one, because it basically showed what a cult-like atmosphere for Mario there was, which I kind of like, just the Mario.
Yes.
But
it was a version of Hands Across America that worked.
But my favorite Japanese one is actually the one they did for Super Mario All-Stars, because they make it look like they're all going to the premiere of a movie, because it also ends with like, also Super Mario Brothers the movie in Japanese theaters now. But
don't see it.
Every character is on model but dressed up to go to a show.
I remember like Peach getting out of a limo or whatever.
Yeah,
it's really
like
cool,
a big
yeah.
red carpet premiere. It's I love this situation. There's a million great Mario
I think, as we've said, go to YouTube and look up all the Japanese Mario commercials or Japanese video game commercials. They're always a lot better because they're just very well animated. The Mario Kart ones in particular, like, I want a Mario Kart anime that looks like that. I think I've said that before. So our next question comes from Eric Plunk, who says, do you think there's a place in today's video game market for a follow-up to Mario Paint? I like to turn that M upside down and see a Wario Paint title that's part Art Academy and part WarioWare. Now, Eric, that's very interesting. I feel like WarioWare Do-It-Yourself was a spiritual Mario Paint sequel.
Well, and then meanwhile there was also Flipnote Studio, which no longer exists, but the Flipnote was also meant to do that. They even got all my information I have on Yuichi Kotabe's career with Nintendo was
the
interview he did to Wada Asks he did to advertise Flipnote. And so they have tried it. Do it yourself was kind of closest to it. I hope, you know, it would have really fit well with a Wii U if it had actually succeeded.
Yeah.
The Switch really isn't something you're supposed to draw on like you would with a Wii U gamepad. So,
yeah. I mean, do you agree with me on the DIY thing?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, DIY was it.
I bought a copy of that two Portland Retro Gaming Expos ago, and I really want to try it out. It looks so cool and so complicated. The instruction book, they used to give you books back then, is like 100 pages.
Yeah, I remember they had a very big presence for it at the Game Developers Conference that year, too, where I got basically their press pack for it was, it's a white t-shirt. Draw your Wario stuff on it. It's like this. Like, yeah.
That's pretty nice. Yeah. It's no Doodle Bear. Mm-hmm. So go ahead with the next one.
All right. Another one close to my heart from Matt M. My fondest Mario memories center around the Super Mario Brothers 3 McDonald's promotion offering the greatest of all the Happy Meals of my childhood. Playing the game, eating the nuggets, collecting the toys. Life was never better.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Though I have to say, as a connoisseur of McDonald's toys, which like my mom was more obsessed with them than me, and so I had every I had almost every Happy Meal toy because my mom wanted to collect them all. The actual quality of the toys you got in the Mario 3 ones kind of sucked, but they do a thing I hate if I may review old Happy Meal toys. They shouldn't be a fucking gimmick. They should be a toy I can play with.
Yeah.
So like, oh, this Mario springs up. Like, you overthought this. Just give me a toy of Mario as a raccoon. Because I can't actually buy that in America otherwise.
At least the Koopa one had moving parts. I do remember getting the Koopa. I really wanted the Koopa. Actually, I'm pretty sure I was out shopping with my grandma at an outlet mall, which is famous in the Midwest, just to get off-brand items for really cheap. On the way back, we went to McDonald's. Like, oh, the Mario toys are here, and I really wanted the Koopa, and I got it. It was like life never got better. It's just all downhill since then.
And I liked the Goomba could do a flip, which was like cute and all the first time. But
I don't think it really worked that well.
No, I'd have to like lick the suction cup on it to make it stick.
That's disgusting.
So, but when I was nine and saw that commercial, I was like, well, this is the greatest thing of all time. I'm going to get a new Mario game, and then I can also have all the toys from it, and everything I love is telling me to buy Mario, and this is the greatest day ever. So I did indeed love it.
Man, all the neurons firing in your brain in like a Pavlovian way, like you're connecting video games with bad food, with toys, just like what's going on in there? I want to know.
Colorful commercials talking to you about it. And I remember the ad was really smart ad too, of like Mario, Raccoon Mario is hitting coin blocks, except they're Happy Meal boxes.
I think we played one of those on the Mario 3 episode, if I recall. So, Cloudy Music wants to know, what's the deal with Peach? Is she the sole human inhabitant of the Mushroom Kingdom? Why is she royalty of a nation that's apparently populated entirely by toads? That's a good question, and they really don't know what to do with that that question in games. I think the Mario RPG games come the closest where you see there's usually a kingdom or like a castle and like a town around the castle, but it's all mushroom people. And there's never a queen or a king. There is like usually like a chancellor that helps Peach, but
Toadsworth, basically the good Jafar of the
Not all chancellors are evil. Don't believe what they tell you on TV and movies.
I don't know, Star Wars gave me a pretty negative outlook on chancellors.
But I mean, what is your theory? I mean,
well, I think going back to how Miyamoto drew her in the original drawing, scale wise she originally was the same size as a toad, so I think she was supposed to be seen as like Nintendo has very different official opinions on gender with toads, and that toads choose their gender and you can be a toad or a toadette, and it sounds very open-minded. But perhaps in the original idea Miyamoto had for it, of just like, no, there's only like a queen bee, there is one female toad, and they are this tiny woman with human hair as opposed to a little hat thing or a toad head. But as it went on, she just became a human, I think, because they realized, like, well, Mario needs to be in love with a human. And actually, she's prettier if she's taller than him. And she has to hit the... She kind of had to become a Pauline type as well. And so, I know in the Mario and Luigi games, they kind of goof around about it, too. But, like, all the toads love her, and she is not... She seems to be a benevolent king who just kind of stands back, and a benevolent monarch. And I think she also doesn't make too many policy decisions. It definitely seems like Toadsworth makes them.
She's a little flighty for that. I mean, I feel like if Star Wars can base a movie around, we're going to learn Han Solo's real name. Oh, my God. A Nintendo game could be like, you're going to meet the king of the Mushroom Kingdom in this game. And it'll be just as disappointing. It's just like, oh, just a green mushroom guy.
You know, it's something Zelda... The Zelda games didn't touch on for a long time until they weren't like, nah, we're not going to show you a king, until I'd say Wind Waker was when they decided, no, a king matters. We need a king for it. We need to have a king of Hyrule for this story to work.
Right.
And so that's when they pulled them in. Also in Minish Cap, too, after that, the king was a major
character. Where was the king in A Link to the Past? Was he, sick or hiding or something?
I think he... Man, I can't remember.
The game starts with Ganon's train overrun the castle, or Aghanim. Yeah,
I think the king is definitely missing, but there's not really... You don't see him on screen. I'm on here as a Mario expert. I wasn't prepared for these answers here.
Stop with these curveballs. All right, you're up next.
Okay. Wavo said, I feel that Mario Brothers here in the United States has surpassed the mainstream superiority of Disney's Mickey Mouse. The Mario Brothers series is likely to continue for another 30 years, and by then I should be happily playing Super Mario Brothers games as I am beginning retirement. Question, will there be any possible scenario where my assumption may turn out to be false, anything possible that may tarnish or abase the Mario series and not let it last for future generations. Love the show. Well, first off, that it's interesting they mentioned the Mickey Mouse thing, because that was like this apocryphal story that I feel is sourced back to the David Saff's Game Over book, which is...
Yeah, I heard it a lot back in the early 90s.
Yeah, and that book is such an important work of American video game history and Japanese. It was one of the few English language books that would tell you anything about Nintendo history, though there's some parts in it directly from Hank Rogers and Yuri, the inventor of Tetris. They told me...
Yuri, Russian last name.
Yes. They both... Pajitnov?
Pajitnov, yeah. Alexei, whatever.
Alexei Pajitnov. Yeah, anyway, both of those guys told me that book gets the spirit of the story right, but gets multiple facts wrong to tell a story.
I see.
But anyway, in that book he says, oh, and this one Pew Research Group thing says Mario's more recognizable to kids than Mickey. I don't know if that's the case now, but I think Nintendo is definitely in the Disney-esque groove of keeping Mario current. And until there comes a day when they don't care about that, when they don't feel like investing... Like, they could make the mistake Konami made with Castlevania, perhaps, or like Capcom did too, of just like, we can take 5 years off. No, nothing of this. People do forget. A generation of children, like we said about how time works for kids, if you take 5 years off of making anything about your most popular character, children will forget, and you will have an entire generation who doesn't know Mario.
I've said on podcasts, that's why I don't go crazy for Star Wars, because that was when George Lucas was like, I'm bored of this, I'm sick of it, just watch the VHS tapes and play with the old toys, I don't care. And that was
same
like,
with like Ghostbusters too.
Yeah.
The only people who care about Ghostbusters were kids of the 80s, because in the 90s, nobody kept it going. It's a very businessy bullshit thing to say, but it is like you have to keep a brand current, and if you don't, then you have to spend a lot of money. You'll probably end up spending more money to make it current again if you want it to be.
Yeah, and I think that Mario, I'm not sure if he'll ever eclipse Mickey, because Disney owns everything but Nintendo right now, but I think that Mario was created in the 80s as a man out of time. He's very much a working class guy of the 30s. You can see him in like an old newspaper comic, you know, climbing up girders and stuff. He was made to sort of reflect that whole Fleischer Brothers kind of New York style of animation and stuff like that. So I feel like having been out of time since he was created will make him timeless, because like things like Bubsy the Bobcat are like, that's so 90s. Even Sonic, I'm surprised actually Sonic still sticks around, even though it's not my thing. I'm still surprised, because he is such a 90s creation. I think maybe if he had sunglasses, he would not be sticking around. But
I think he's more versatile than you think, because like, one, he's nude, so other than his shoes, so that means you can add more clothes to him to make him for a style of a time, and you can change him up. And also, I do like seeing one of my absolute favorite things in Sonic Mania is the opening animation, the original animation, which is done by mega dorkos like us who got into animation, who grew up in the 90s. They want him to look really cool, but in that specific way of having his long hot dog nose and his fat belly. And so,
yeah, actually, I will take that back. I think when in our Sonic episode, the character designer said I gave him the head of Felix the Cat and the body of Mickey Mouse, and those are characters from like the 20s and 30s. Yeah. So maybe that has made Sonic's design and like just the general aesthetic around him stay kind of timeless. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Podcast One. We love hearing from you. We read every tweet and comment you send our way. So don't miss your chance to take our summer listener survey. Just go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner, or go to podcastone.com/my survey. It only takes a few minutes, and it gives you the opportunity to make a direct impact on your favorite shows. Tell us how you really feel so we can get to know you better. We value your thoughts and participation. So check out the survey at podcastone.com/my survey, or click on the survey banner on podcastone.com.
You know, when you're a kid, there are a lot of things that you think exist. Unicorns, dragons, mermaids, you name it. When you're a kid, it's real. But when you find out later that they don't, well, it's kind of disappointing. Of course, as you get older, you get over the disappointment. But when you're looking to buy a car, there's nothing worse than finding the one of your dreams online, and then you find out later it doesn't really exist. It's not true. That's why at TrueCar, they show you real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing offered to you by TrueCar. It's an actual VIN-based price from a TrueCar-certified dealer in your area. Real prices. And these aren't just any dealers either. TrueCar-certified dealers are a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency. They offer competitive prices and a faster, easier buying experience for you. It's a fact. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with the TrueCar certified dealers. And, on average, they save over $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that dream car, visit TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Hey friends, I don't watch sports or gamble, but as you might know from my other podcast, Talking Simpsons, I am an expert in that particular subject. And as The Simpsons taught us all, gambling makes sports even better. So if I started watching sports, I'd definitely start gambling. And since where you're betting at is just as important as who you're betting on, I'd make my destination mybookie.ag. MyBookie has been in this business for years, and their rep is rock solid. They do 100% cash bonuses, so off the bat you're making money for doing nothing. And they have the fastest payouts, seriously, just 2 business days. That's why I'm urging all of you Retronauts listeners to make your way to MyBookie. You win, they pay. They have in-game live betting, the most rewarding player perks in the business, and an all-new mobile site that makes wagering on the go a breeze. And if you join now, MyBookie will match your deposit with up to a 100% bonus. Just visit MyBookie.ag today and use the promo code RETRO to activate this exclusive offer. Remember, that's MyBookie.ag. You play, you win, you get paid.
Super Mario is back. He's blasting through worlds where no one has ever been. He's taking on enemies no one else dares. This time, Mario plucks up power wherever he goes, so he's bigger and badder than ever before. You've never seen creatures like these. You've never had an adventure like this. It's everything you've dreamed of and worlds more. It's Super Mario 2, only from Nintendo. Now you're playing with power.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile's super reliable, super fast nationwide network and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
So Mike wants to know, after a little bit of a preamble, he says, what does the Mario series represent to you? Thanks so much for your consistently thoughtful and excellent discussion about gaming history. Well, thank you, Mike.
Yeah.
I think, I'm saying this multiple times. I've said this before, but, well, I have said it before. And I think Mario games are sort of like the benchmark of what everything to follow. Like, you're not going to meet the standard, but here's how you design this kind of a game. So, like, mm-hmm. Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers was like, okay, guys, here's what a 2D platformer looks like. There's been some in the past that they weren't as good as this. You at least have to try to be as good as this. And with Mario 64, it's like, here's how a game works in 3D. This is how it has to be from now on because Mario 64 exists. That's what Mario means to me. Maybe that's not what the Mario series does anymore, but I feel like they did establish a formula and a format and genre with many mm-hmm. games before the turn of the century.
Yeah, I think the ones after 64 did it in a lighter way, but I do think like 3D Land at least showed here's how you do a real 3D platformer on a handheld, which hadn't really been done that well before. And I think the Galaxy game showed, here's how you do a much more directed, focused version of the open world stuff we'd done in 64. And I'd also say that the new Super Mario Brothers really disappointed me, but I don't think it held a bar of quality up. It did definitely show, it repopularized retro games coming back, or like these throwback type titles. It started happening a lot more, I think, after the 2004 release or six of New Super Mario.
Yeah, Bros. I think with how much that game sold, as much as I don't like playing it, I feel like it did make it okay to make 2D games again, because we were of the mindset like, well, there's not going to be any 2D games, maybe just on handhelds. Mm-hmm. But it sold so much that people started making 2D games again.
Ridiculous amounts of money. I can only imagine how many games got greenlit in a meeting because the person pitching it said, well, and you know, New Super Mario Brothers sold 30 million copies.
Yeah, there's no saying no to that. So that's our answer for you.
Okay. Alex R. Musa says, I love the revelation that Super Mario Brothers 3 was a stage play. The game begins with a curtain opening. Environmental platforms are actually set dressing, either bolted to the background or suspended from the sky. And everything casts a shadow on the background as if the sky were actually a flat backdrop. Miyamoto himself confirmed it in 2015, and links to a Kotaku article on that. This would make it a precursor to visually stylized Nintendo games like the kids' crayon drawing look of Yoshi's Island, the knitted yarn aesthetic of Kirby's Epic Yarn and Yoshi's Woolly World, or the claymation stylings of Kirby and the Rainbow Curse. The interesting thing was how many of us played this game, that how few people noticed the stage play aesthetic. I would argue that Mario games were already so psychedelic to most audiences in the late 80s that few of us were really deconstructing what we were seeing. The whole thing was surreal, so why try to make sense of bolt suspension wires and drop shadows?
Yeah, I think I just took it for granted. It only years later did I realize, just like, oh yeah, you're kind of exiting stage left at the end of every stage game. You're going behind the scenes when you duck on the white blocks, and yeah, all the blocks do have bolts in them, like they're bolted to the background.
The game begins with a curtain going up on a stage, even. Like,
yeah,
so,
and like the whole cast is out there like running around too.
But I think that we as kids, or even non-kids playing that game, were like, well, a game wouldn't be postmodern, a game wouldn't be meta or have commentary on like, oh, this is a stage play. And I think too, they did as best they could, like with the visual ability they had then, like the claymation look of Kirby and the Rainbow Curse, which is a gorgeous game. I love that game. But I think they can only really achieve that with the fidelity they have now. They definitely couldn't do that
not
on 8-bit.
The NES. Yeah. I think it's great. And actually, if you play Mario Maker, they actually have things cast more shadows in the background. So they're kind of building up that aesthetic even more that they couldn't do on the NES. Like the Mario sprite casts a little shadow on the background in Mario Maker. So I guess they just liked how that aesthetic looked. So we're up next with Ryan Haas, who says, while I would not state outright that Mario plus Raving Rabbids and Super Mario Odyssey are necessarily inspired by Super Mario Brothers the movie, I would still argue that the film represents a certain touchstone of the overall franchise by which later games in canon developments can be compared. How much, if at all, do the Retronauts consider the film an influence on the franchise? I will say less than 0%.
Less than zero, I absolutely believe that Nintendo washed their hands of it the moment they did. It was shooting even before the release, and they just had contractual obligations to help advertise it. I've seen interviews where Miyamoto gets asked, so is his name really Mario? Mario's like, look, we did that for the movie. No, it's not his name. Okay.
Yes.
And so I also think every Mario game, if the movie wasn't called Super Mario Brothers, it wouldn't be a good movie, but I think people could at least appreciate, like, wow, this is great set design, or what an interesting world it builds. But
yeah,
it is the world is such an absolute rejection of everything that people loved Mario for.
It's true.
And every game, even the American developed Mario games, which I'd say like the Mario versus Donkey Kong series, those don't give a shit about the Super Mario Brothers movie.
They don't, yeah, and I feel like the sets are great, but for another movie. Mm-hmm. They're really impressive, but not for a Mario movie. It's just like, they're kind of like running around in a Blade Runner world no reason. And there are so many, I mean, we did an entire episode about this movie in 2012. You can go to archive.org and find all the 1UP episodes because they're hard to find now. But I said everything I wanted to say about it then. I don't think my feelings have changed, but there's just so much wrong about that movie.
Yeah.
Even as a kid, I was just like, no, I want my Mario movie like I want it. And it just, I don't know who they were making it for. I feel a certain shame of the source material. Like, oh, we have to make
absolutely.
This crap? Yeah.
I mean, that's why they don't get in their costumes until like the last 10 minutes.
Yeah,
just like, so they could, probably just because they're like, we can't make a toy if they're not in these costumes.
Yes.
Fine.
That's funny because I remember watching this for that episode and I'm like, when are they going to get into the costumes? They find their own costumes in Koopa's base.
Yes.
And it's the hour and 40 minute mark, I'm pretty sure, when it happens. Just like, they are so ashamed. But just like, I feel like that's how superhero movies were like until fairly recently. Like we can't have these guys in costumes. That's stupid.
It looks so dumb.
Yeah.
Ugh.
But now we have super red Spider-Man swinging around. It's great.
Yeah. No, I'd say Iron Man really changed that. Definitely. All right. So Jason X says, curious to hear what you guys think about the continuity of the Mario franchise. This is very important to me.
Oh boy.
Says Henry. continuing, Miyamoto has supposedly said that he views the characters as being akin to old Warner Brothers cartoons, where each new outing has little, if any, relationship to its predecessors. Even so, I'll be in the cold, cold ground before I recognize Koopa Jr. over the true Koopa kids. Should the fans take a more laissez-faire attitude to Mario canon, or are we justified in desperately clinging to our preferred configurations like some kind of peach-shaped body pillow? Well, I will definitely I absolutely respect Miyamoto on this, and I'd say if anybody is the last word on Mario canon, it's him. And he totally doesn't give a single shit about Mario canon. He, when asked about it, like, so who's the mother of Bowser's kids? I don't care. Like, his answer for most
this
of
interview's
is
over.
He'll be nice and be like, yeah, look, it doesn't matter. Mario's last name is this. Okay, who's older? Which brother? He's like, he doesn't care. But I think a lot of people who work on Mario games do care, and I think you can definitely find moments of canon being built in there by people, maybe not him, that kind of fit around it. I'm especially mega interested to see what they do in Mario Odyssey, because Mario Odyssey, he wears all these costumes he wore in classic games. It is recognizing, like, here's this costume from Yoshi's Cookie. Here's this costume from Mario's Picross. Here's this costume from one scene from the Game Boy launch game that was a ripoff of Breakout.
Alleyway.
Yeah, it's costume from one screen of Alleyway. All
it's
these
amazing
things in there that I'm like, well, okay, somebody really gives a shit. It reminds me of how it reminds me of how Breath of the Wild is like, oh, every Zelda game kind of counts in
right
this.
I like the idea of references more than the tying everything to like a specific history. Like, I like when Zelda Breath of the Wild rewards you with,
yeah,
like, remember this from this game, it's here in this form. And same with Mario Odyssey, seeing like the Yoshi's Cookie costume and things like that. I'm not a biggest fan of saying like, when were they born and when did they arrive in the Mushroom Kingdom and stuff, because there's like a different story in every TV series. And then like Yoshi's Island contradicts that. They were like,
yeah,
born in the Mushroom Kingdom.
Well,
it's
they
like,
were delivered,
yeah,
in the Mushroom Kingdom, but then the other Yoshi's
to humans
Island games,
I think
definitely not to mushroom
I
people.
Think we just see their legs,
yeah.
Yeah, they
but they do
off
live in a mushroom house.
That's true.
But as I will say on a Yoshi's Island episode, in Yoshi's Island sequels, they then say that wasn't the family and they have to be dropped off at another house. And there's another thing in Mario continuity, which I feel really should count, that people kind of overlook, is that in Donkey Kong 94, which is a Miyamoto-ass Mario game, so if any continuity counts, it's that one. When you finish that game and defeat Donkey Kong, DK Jr., Mario, and Pauline fall into the Mushroom Kingdom, drawn to look like Super Mario Brothers 1 Mushroom Kingdom.
Interesting.
So it's like, oh, so is this how they say that 94, that how the Donkey Kong story then drops Mario off in the Mushroom Kingdom? There's many answers to that, and I do think Odyssey showed some. So you're not wrong to care about continuity, because some people making Mario games do care about it, but just know that ultimately, as long as Miyamoto is alive, he will hand wave away any attempt you have,
yeah,
to say, like, well, so did Bowser Jr. be born after this? Like, he doesn't care.
I will say, let's please not turn this into a Legend of Zelda timeline thing. Oof. More pointless conversations have been had about that than probably any other topic in history. What makes me, I'm so mad about the timeline.
Well, I made you write, well, I paid you.
I did take money for
yes,
it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did write an article for GamesRadar about like sort of, I think, breaking down the timeline. Mm-hmm. And what blew my mind about it, I had not even read the official timeline or seen the book Hyrule Story until I sat down to write that article. And it begins with a preface. It's like, none of this is true. None of this is real. We can change this whenever we want to. So it's like, well, then why does anyone have conversations about this? I guess it's true of all fiction. It's all made up anyway, so who cares? But it's just like, I just like the idea that the Wind Waker kind of put forth that, like, oh, it's a different Link every time or whatever. And I wish we could just have that back. It was so pure and special. But yes, that's my my final word on that. So next question comes from Lef Lowick. I'm currently studying / doing research about game history, and I love how memories and anecdotes can paint a picture of how games were played back in the days. So my questions would be, do you have any funny / quirky / unique anecdotes about you linked to the Mario Brothers series and how you played them? One for me. When I was young, we didn't know the name of Big Bertha, so we always called her Colette Gosselin, French-Canadian name, for some reason. It's still how we call her in my family. And I even gave her name to my young corgi. Always a pleasure to listen to you. Thanks. I just remember my older sister would always make fun of me for knowing the enemy names.
Yes, yeah.
And like I was a nerd. Like I was probably like 7 and she was 10. And I was like, she was playing. I was like, oh, jump on that Goomba. She's like, Goomba? You know the names of these things? We get along great, by the way, still today.
I did have that same obsessiveness of going through, the instruction manual's there, you have to. And also, as somebody who watched all of the cartoons, I was like, well, okay, that's a blooper, that's a shy
right.
guy, that's
a Mouser,
that's a ninja, a Mouser. I knew all those names, and so that's why I would obsessively call them that. So I didn't make up names for them. Definitely a big memory I have is how obsessed me and my mom were, and my little brother were, with Super Mario Brothers, that we bought our first ever strategy guide, which was just print ups of every stage in order and how to get through them. And it was a good time. It was a happy memory, as was my mom loved Dr. Mario, probably her favorite game ever. And she would beat it all the time. And just watching over her shoulder, or watching together, the very melancholy moment of the viruses on top of a tree watching like fireworks together. It was
it's very Japanese too.
Yes, yeah.
that tree should have been pink. Yeah, for some reason I'm just remembering this in 1990 or 89, whenever that game came out. Moms did love Dr. Mario, and I don't know why. Yeah. Moms come a run into those colorful pills.
My mom played it all the time on the Game Boy as well, until after school I lost the Game Boy cartridge. I think some kid stole it from me, and she was very disappointed I lost the Game Boy cartridge.
He's got the prescription for my daily blues.
Kevin Bunch says, when being a Mario obsessed kid, my parents indulged me whenever something related to the franchise came by my hometown of Detroit. I remember they took me to the Ice Capades Mario and Ice production, which I still have the pendant from, and to a traveling exhibit Nintendo put on to advertise the Super NES shortly after its launch. One of the most striking things I remember, there was a floating, talking Mario head, sort of like the Super Mario 64 opening, that would crack jokes and make wise guy comments. I read just a few years ago that was done by having Charles Martinet, in the display area, effectively improvising everything he was saying. Do you have any insight on that one? I also recall a Link to the Past promo video with voiceover from the cartoon's actor. Well, I don't remember that one. And I love it if that ever surfaced on the internet. I don't recall that Link to the Past one at all.
I have never seen it, but that probably was Charles Martinet.
Oh, yeah. I've read many a Charles Martinet interview, and he was very clear. Like, that was when he started. He said that Nintendo needed a voice for Mario for this trade show they were doing, just to show off this, 3D Mario head, and they'd need a guy to talk over that head. And so they get this guy who does a cutesy Italian accent. He says like he had a more gruff Italian accent at first, and he didn't know it was Mario he was auditioning for. And they're like, no, cutesier. And so then we got that voice, and he tells stories that he just basically did a ton of Italian stereotype jokes. Like, oh, where's Luigi? He's off a camera making a spaghetti.
Yeah, actually, that's funny you said that, because I was at an E3. I forget which E3 it was, but he was there, not visible. But
this was a 2014 when I
2014,
think,
yeah,
I was there
that was my last E3 I went to. But
or 2013,
one of those. I was at both of those, but I remember the Mario head talking to people, and somebody was like, somebody did ask, where's Luigi? He's like, oh, he's making the pasta.
Oh, yeah, he did that.
And then the Italian Anti-Defamation League showed up and arrested him.
I remember he did that. This was right before the show floor opened, so it was like, it's only press there. And I can't remember the journalist he said, but like, oh, it's that guy from a Polygon. You say so many nice things about a Mario. Hey, I was like, this is weird.
That's considered a bribe, sir. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that was Charles Martinet and
Nintendo.
Yes.
The NCL Masters, I think, even more so than Nintendo of America. Like, oh, we like this guy. They like him so much. Like, they don't. Unlike with, say, Solid Snake, there is not a Japanese Mario voice. It is Charles Martinet.
That's right,
as well.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, yes, you will find ads for like the Cat Mario puppet. Obviously, that is a Japanese actor speaking in Japanese in a Mario voice. But in the games, like, I remember 3D World. One of the things I loved most about when I got to interview the creators for 3D World, and that included Miyamoto. They mentioned how much they loved hearing meow, because that is not the Japanese onomatopoeia. But they heard Charles Martinet doing meow meow. They're like, this is adorable. We love the way you make a cat.
We're building a game around this now.
And so they were very insistent, like in Japan as well. It was Charles Martinet and the other actors saying, meow, not meow.
Yeah, that's cool. Wow, I wonder if that opened up a lot of Japanese people's eyes to our world of onomatopoeia. Mm-hmm.
The right way to say a cat noise.
I prefer gow as the cow sound.
I like kukuriku or kikiriki that roosters do in Spanish.
I prefer Juan to bark.
Juan. That's weird. That
one's Juan.
Juan.
That's
how
it works.
I guess that makes more sense than bark, bark.
Yeah. So let's just do a few more. We got so many questions, and we're reading them in whoever actually posted first. We're kind of going in order, so you snooze, you lose. But yes. I read all of these, so thank you for your contributions.
Uh-huh.
And let's go on to Charlie Manny, who says, my first Mario game I played was Super Mario 64 when I was 7, but the first one I owned was Super Mario All-Stars plus Super Mario World. Since then, in my past 21 years, I played just about every Mario game. I was wondering just a few things. Number one, which Mario game do you think has been overhyped? Number two, what Mario game would you love to re-experience for the first time? Number three, what do you want out of Mario Odyssey? These are three questions. I wanted one. let's pick one of these to answer, just to be fair to everyone else. How about...
That I could play again.
Yeah, let's do that one.
It absolutely is Yoshi's Island for me. Mm. I think Yoshi's Island... It's really hard to say. It's tied for first place with like two other Mario games for me as my favorite, and it is a Mario game. I will not couch any conversation otherwise. but just experiencing like every boss fight in that for the first time was like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah, new special effects. Yeah. I'll say mine would be Mario 64, just to have my innocence back about like this is the first time a 3D game has felt right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure I don't even know if I played Doom or whatever before that, but it's the first time it's just like, oh, this is how games are going to be now, and this is cool. Like,
you kids don't know what a marvelous moment it was to be like, oh, this is what a 3D game is. All these other 3D games are bullshit. Like, this is what a 3D game is.
And just, like, looking around every corner, climbing every tree, like, oh my god, there's a waterfall. How deep can I swim? It just was like, that, even just being in a 3D world was enough of a novelty, and it was great that there was a great game attached to it that controlled well. So, thanks. We have one from Frowny Face. I'm not sure if he's trolling us. Do you want to read this one, Henry?
Sure. Oh boy. Frowny Face said, the emoji of a frowny face says, are there any black people in the Mario universe? That is a toughie.
Yeah.
You know, there are very few humans in the Mario universe.
That's true.
So I'll say that too. Or human looking people. As far as, black people, because using the term African American, that would preclude other dark skinned people who are not from America. But anyway, enough about nomenclature on that. I can't.
Well, Mario was in blackface once, but that doesn't count, right?
We don't talk about that.
That was in Kix, the Game Boy version of Kix, I think.
It was.
Yes,
it was.
Dark memories.
Look, Japan...
Listen, it was 1990.
Japan has learned... Nintendo has learned quite a lot. Nintendo Japan has learned quite a lot about how blackface is not acceptable outside of Japan, where it somehow kind of still is.
Yeah.
A little bit. But
the baggage is not attached to it.
But anyway, getting away from that, I definitely can't think of one off the top of my head because it's pretty rare. I bet I would hope we will see some in Mario Odyssey. It would be weird to go to a version of New York City that only had white people in it. That would be very
strange.
That would
be weird. It'd be like an episode of Friends or something like that.
Exactly.
Old joke, but it's still true. I think all the humans in Mario are Italian. They're all Italian-Americans.
Yeah, pretty much Italian-Americans, other than Peach, who is just like standard white lady, though. We already talked about.
Waluigi was grown in a lab, I think.
So... yeah, they're I hate to disappoint people, but I can't really think of any. I think there might be some in the WarioWare games, if those are, you know, Nintendo adjacent, but yeah, sorry. I need to dig more into this, but none are coming to mind.
Prove us wrong, listeners. Prove us wrong. Let's read one more question. I'm just gonna pick one at random. That's good. So our last question comes from RelloMain23, who asks, Super Mario Land 1 and 2 were my first Mario games and are highly regarded by me. Why do you think none of that content, enemies, bosses, stages, etc., were carried into the Mario universe? Would you like to see Mario Land 1 and 2 rolled into Mario Maker? 2D Mario games versus 3D Mario games, if you had to pick one. I will say that those were, back when Nintendo still had their different teams, those were R&D 1 games, and the Mario series were they R&D 3 or 4? The mainline Mario games.
I believe it was, I think 3, I think they were EAD at that time.
Okay, I thought EAD was like 3 and 4 smashed together over time.
Yeah, pretty much, but yeah, they were 3 and 4, I believe it was. Yeah.
It was, I will say, like, Mario Land 1, 2, and then the Wario Land series were made by not Mario team people. Mm-hmm. And by the time they got to Mario Land 2, it was already becoming a parody of Mario games. And Mario Land 3 is just an outright parody of Mario games. And I point out all the reasons why in our Wario Land episodes, like episode 2 of our comeback. Please listen to it. I love the Wario Land games, but I feel like they were more interested in being weird and breaking formula than, you know, the main Mario people were.
And I love that those goofballs were ready to, like, joke on it and goof on Mario. But also, if I was, I don't know, if I was a very controlling person about making Mario games, like perhaps... like perhaps Miyamoto and Takashi are about it, they might be mad that somebody changed up things so much. But because the other people who made Mario Land 1 and 2 had such seniority, they could just do it. And I think you end up... Land 1 and 2 is what happens when you ask people who are not the Mario team to make a Mario game. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at making games, but they don't know how to exactly make a Mario game. Like, Mario Land is just so weird.
It has some defenders. I like some of the ideas, but I just find it very hard to play. Like, Mario drops like a brick. Like, he just immediately just drops like a lead balloon.
Yeah, the physics are a little off, and also you can tell they were more interested in like doing like shooting stages.
Yeah,
I think they did better with shooting stages.
Those
than
are more
they did
fun.
Trying to fake Mario, and then just the weird idea of like, oh, these are kind of Koopa Troopers, but they turn into bombs.
Yeah,
like,
again, they're kind of playing with the ideas, but I think Mario Land 2 is a great game, and the Wario Land series, obviously, I love.
I love Mario Land 2, and I felt like Mario Land 2 was them trying to be more like a Mario, Super Mario World. It was made
in the shadow
of Super Mario World, so it had more directed power-ups, cuter sprites, bigger worlds, but it still is a weird-ass game, especially in the case of, like, Wario is a weird-ass character. Like,
I love Wario.
We're just so used to Wario now. It's like, no, it's an uglier, fatter, meaner Mario who is what Mario really would be if he was honest, which is like, I'm a greedy guy who loves coins. Give
That's
me a
true.
All.
Okay, I never thought of that. Like, yeah, like, Mario's really just out for coins, you
exactly.
know?
Exactly, but Mario's got to have that happy face on. And I do recall when I got to interview the director of Super Mario 3D Land about the game, I did ask, like, you know, it has the same name style as the Mario Land games. Like, what inspiration do you take from that? And he was pretty demure of, like, not really any. Like, this was, to the EAD team, I don't think they feel it was those are Mario games worth emulating. Though the closest he said is, like, well, the fireballs in this game kind of bounce off walls like the balls do in Land. That was the most he said. But so, I think EAD, who is calling the shots... no employee there particularly cares much for those Land games because they didn't make them if they were there when they were being made. So I think that's why they're not really taken into account.
Yeah, the Wario fields are lying fallow. I really want a new Wario game that's good and not outsourced. And Game & Wario wasn't, but it was still bad. I reviewed it and not great. Not a great Wii U game. So yeah, that was our Mario Q&A. Thank you so much to everyone who posted a comment. There are more of them, but we were at an hour. And for God's sakes...
Oh my God, we went that long!
We're at an hour. And these micros... peek behind the scenes. They're supposed to be like 20 minutes. We never do that. We're giving you so much extra. I'm not trying to guilt trip anyone. I love reading these comments. And if you enjoyed us doing this, let me know if you want me to do more of these. I have fun sitting down and, frankly, not having to do a bunch of research. That part of it is great, too. But it's good to hear from you guys. And it's good to hear, you know, your ideas and stuff reflected in our podcast. So thank you so much. And I should have pointed out, like, I'm doing this podcast because Mario plus Rabbids just came out and is apparently good. And I should probably play it. And Mario Odyssey is like 2 months away. So we're like at the dawn of a new age of Mario, a new 3D Mario that's not like these little prescribed levels. It's back to the Mario Sunshine and Mario 64 kind of approach. And I'm very excited about that. I know Henry is too.
Absolutely. And I love its seeming celebration of Mario history, which they really don't do in games. And so just having these conversations or reading these questions further reminded me, like, oh yeah, I'm really excited for Odyssey and what it offers up in Mario history celebration.
I can't wait to get it. I have a Switch and I'm ready for Odyssey. But let's wrap up. As always, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. And you're listening to Retronauts, by the way. Thank you very much. My other podcast is Talking Simpsons. And because of all of our great Patreon people, we can record in Henry's apartment and I don't have to go all the way to San Francisco and spend 2 hours in transit to do that. So thank you so much. Talking Simpsons is a chronological exploration of The Simpsons every Wednesday on the LaserTime Podcast Network. And I'll let Henry tell you all about that Patreon and what you can get if you want to donate to that. Retronauts has a Patreon too, of course, and we thank all of you donors to that. But we have a lot of crossover fans. And Henry, please let people know what they can get if they also give their hard-earned money to Talking Simpsons.
Yeah, so if you go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons and sign up for just $5 a month, you will get access to dozens already exclusive podcasts. So you'll get the entire first season of Talking Simpsons, which is only available there. You'll get all of our exclusive season wrap-ups, which now includes deleted scenes as well from season 5. And you will also get every episode of Talking Critic, which is us doing the same kind of history rewatch treatment to The Critic, the first spin-off-ish of The Simpsons ever. And we're having a ton of fun on those. You get so many extras from there. And yeah, that's how we were able to do things like get the equipment to buy get the equipment to record here and then have the free time to do it in Berkeley instead of having to fit this around a full-time job. And yes, I really appreciate everybody who has made that possible.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone who donates anything to either Patreon. We appreciate it so much. And if you're interested in the Retronauts Patreon, that's patreon.com/retronauts. There are perks to that, but I feel the most important perk is the $3 tier. And with that, you get ad-free episodes at a higher bitrate and a week earlier. We know some of you don't like the ads. They're a necessary thing for us to make this our full-time jobs. But if you want to go around the ads, it's only $3 a month, which I think comes out to like 50 cents per podcast. It's a time/money equation. You decide which is more valuable. I won't do it for you. But thank you so much for listening to Retronauts, and we'll see you soon with another brand new episode.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of
chocolate.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.